Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is Tim Kasser, a professor of psychology at Knox College in Illinois and author of various books on materialism, values, well-being and environmental sustainability, including The High Price of Materialism, Psychology and Consumer Culture. And he's going to talk to us today about a book he co-authored with Tom Crompton entitled Meeting Environmental Challenges, The Role of Human Identity, and how they see this as being often a missing link in environmental campaigning. Hello, Tim. Welcome to the MWS podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, well, could you begin by telling us a bit about your background, Tim, and how you decided to become involved in this field of work?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a psychologist, and so I'm really interested in the human mind and how it works and all of the things that influence the human mind. And for the last 20 years or so, I've been studying people's values and their goals, because that's part of what people are trying to create in their lives. That's what people think are important and that they're striving for. And that has a lot of implications for how they live their lives, the choices they make, as well as their well-being and other kinds of behaviors we'll talk about later on. So that's sort of what drew me to that area. And the particular focus that I have in people's values and goals has to do especially with their values and goals for what we call extrinsic goals or materialistic goals, to make a lot of money and to have a lot of possessions and to have the right image, which is usually mediated through possessions, etc. So all those kinds of values and goals which corporate consumer capitalism tell us are really important to organize our lives around. So that's mostly what I've been doing over the last 20 years.
Okay, could you now then give us an overview of the book, just to give us an idea?
Sure. Well, the thing I'd start by saying is that Tom Crompton, at the time we started the book, was working at the World Wildlife Fund in the UK. And he came to a talk that I gave at the University of Surrey when I was doing a fellowship there with Tim Jackson, and invited me to come speak at WWF, which was just down the road from Surrey. And afterwards, we had a long, long conversation, Tom and I did, about how to apply psychological knowledge to what environmental campaigners and communicators are doing. Yeah. Tom's sense, and my sense as well, as I've learned more and more, is that while there's a lot of great work out there that environmentalists have done, it by and large has not been well informed by contemporary research in psychology as to how to motivate people or what's important to people or how the human mind works and things like that. And so Tom had been, you know, invested for some years in understanding how to use psychology to make environmental campaigning more effective, because obviously it hasn't been as effective as it could be. And so we ended up writing this book together, the Meeting Environmental Challenges book, which I would note to your listeners can be downloaded for free if you take a look around on the internet. And what we did was we focused on three different aspects of identity that research suggested are relevant to environmental campaigning. The first two I'm not going to talk much about here today, but one has to do with people's coping mechanisms and defense mechanisms, so how they deal with threat and scary things like climate change. Yeah. A second aspect of identity had to do with how people think of their group membership, so that humans kind of think of themselves as different than non-humans, and that might be part of why we treat the environment in not so optimal ways.
Yeah.
And then the third aspect we focused on in the book had to do with people's values and goals. And that's, you know, what most of my research has been about, and that's what, you know, we'll talk about mostly here today in this conversation. So the starting point for our work in this book and for other research that my colleagues and I have done has to do with how values and goals are organized in people's minds. So one of the things we know from, you know, two decades of research, three decades of research in values and goals is that value, any particular value or goal is part of a broader system. Mm-hmm. So to say that, you know, I value money or I value family or I value religion is only meaningful in terms of how much you value that particular aim in life compared to other things you might value, right? And what people like Shalom Schwartz or my colleagues and I have found is that the way that values and goals are organized in people's minds is pretty consistent across different cultures, and that there are different sort of clusters of values and goals that it seems that all people have as particular aims in life.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not going to talk about all the different values and goals that there are. I understand that this interview will include the circumplex models of Schwartz and Grusse, so you can see those of you who are listening and watching. But let me just talk about a few of the most important ones for our purposes. So on the one hand, we have the values and goals that I've already alluded to, what Schwartz calls the self-enhancing goals and what Grusse and myself and others have called the extrinsic goals. So these self-enhancing and extrinsic goals cluster together as a set because they're fairly compatible with each other. And they concern aims like trying to have a lot of money, trying to have high status, trying to be popular, trying to have the right image, trying to achieve a lot. And I think if you think about it, it's pretty obvious that, you know, if I'm striving to make a lot of money, that's fairly psychologically consistent with striving to have high status, right? It's pretty easy to simultaneously pursue those two sets of goals. You can work at them at the same time. Now, another set of values and goals that have been discovered in the value circumplex are what my colleagues call the intrinsic goals, and what Schwartz called the self-transcendent goals. And so the intrinsic goals, we call those intrinsic goals because from our perspective, they're inherently satisfying to pursue because they do a good job of meeting people's psychological needs. And these include goals for things like growing as a person and accepting oneself, what's called the self-acceptance goals, affiliation goals, having close relationships with others, and then community feeling goals, which are trying to make the broader world a better place. Schwartz's idea, he calls some of these goals the self-transcendent goals because they concern something bigger than us, or than us as an individual, okay? So, and those include goals for benevolence, which is kind of like affiliation. It's about close relationships, and goals for universalism, which Schwartz thinks of as goals to help the broader world, just like those community feeling goals. Now, what's really interesting is that in both the Schwartz circumplex model and in the Grusse et al. Circumplex model, what we find is that the self-enhancing extrinsic goals are in relative conflict with the self-transcendent intrinsic goals. That's why they're on the opposite side of the circumplex in the slides that you're hopefully seeing here. And essentially, what this means is that they're relatively difficult to simultaneously pursue those intrinsic goals at the same time you're pursuing the extrinsic goals. It's tough to be really focused on money at the same time as you're going to be focused on trying to help other people have a better life, okay? Right. Being greedy and generous, just you can't really do at the same time very easily.
And does one actually, when you're activating one, suppress the other?
Yeah, and so that's, you know, what we find is that the values and goals are activate or work like a seesaw, basically.
Okay.
So to the extent that you're highly focused in your life or in a particular moment on one set of goals, what happens is that the other set of goals tend to become suppressed, and consistent goals tend to become activated. So what this means is, for example, if I get you thinking about money right now, what's going to happen is you're going to become more motivated to care about money, but you're also going to become more motivated to care about image and status and popularity because those are consistent goals, and you're going to become less motivated to care about being generous and helpful, because those are values on the opposite side of the circumflex.
So there's like a bleed over effect then, in effect.
There's both what we call a bleed over effect and a seesaw effect. So the bleed over effect is when I get you thinking about money that you also think about image and status, those consistent goals. And then the seesaw effect is when, as you think about money, the values on the other side of the circumflex go down and you become less generous, etc. Now, does that all make sense?
Definitely, yeah.
Okay, great. Now, here's why this is important for environmental campaigners and also for social development and social justice campaigners, is what the research shows is that the more that people are focused on those extrinsic materialistic goals for money and power and image and status, the less they tend to care about other people's well-being, the more the competitive they are instead of cooperative, the less empathic they tend to be, the less they tend to act in pro-social ways, and the less they tend to concern themselves about the environment. And we found these kinds of effects both in terms of just looking at people's values in general and in terms of momentarily activating those values. So we know, for example, that people who sort of over the long term say, what's important to me is money and status and image, those people tend to care less about the environment and care less about people outside of, you know, their family. And they also, if I take just your average individual and I momentarily get them thinking about money, that for at least a few moments is going to also suppress their concern for their environment and their concern for the broader world. And the reason that Tom and I wanted to raise this issue and have continued to raise this issue in the 5 years since we published that book is that a lot of environmental campaigners and communicators and some social justice campaigners and communicators, we're essentially trying to sell a better world in the same way that marketers try to sell Coca-Cola or McDonald's or a pair of shoes. They were appealing to image and money and status and those kinds of things. You know, we can save the world and grow the economy, or, you know, what's really in and cool is to be green, right?
That's certainly the case in the UK with the present government policies. It's about if you go green, it's to save you money, basically.
That's absolutely right. And so what's happening is that governmental organizations and civil society organizations and other motivators, in their attempt to appeal to people to be more environmentally sustainable or to be more pro-social, when they do that by saying it'll save money or by you'll be cool or you'll make money, what they're actually doing is activating and encouraging the extrinsic self-enhancing values. Yeah. And that's problematic in two ways. First off, it probably makes that initial appeal somewhat less effective because it's suppressing the pro-social values. And second, and I think ultimately more importantly, it is encouraging people to believe that what's important is to care about money, image, and status. So it's building up that part of the person's value system, and it's building up the part of the value system which over the long term is probably going to make that person less interested in caring about the environment and caring about pro-social outcomes. So it has both – so making those kinds of appeals to extrinsic values has both sort of a short-term negative effect, which we've documented in some studies, and over the long term is likely to undermine broad concern for the sorts of environmental and social outcomes that most civil society organizations care about. Yeah. So that's the basic argument of the book, or at least that part of the book, and what we've continued to do over the last 5 years as we've expanded on those ideas.
Okay. And one of the criticisms of the book, Tim, from environmentalists who are pursuing that approach is that people who are very extrinsically motivated, that you're not going to reach them. But you did a study in Wales, that challenges that. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah, we definitely have been subject to quite a bit of critique for our approach from kind of the established way of doing things. And You know, the first thing I want to say about those who've been critiquing us is that we've asked them over and over and over again to provide us with the data which show that their viewpoint is supported empirically. And they keep telling us that those data are proprietary and therefore they can't share them with us. And which is very frustrating.
Yeah.
It's their viewpoint is also based on a fairly outmoded view of motivation. They tend to pull from a Maslowian viewpoint, which, while I'm actually a big fan of Maslow in a lot of respects, there's actually very little evidence for this Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which those people base their argument on. Essentially, what they say is that, look, you've got people who are extrinsically oriented or self-enhancing oriented. They're concerned about their own safety needs. They're never going to be concerned about those higher intrinsic values. So don't even bother. There's very little evidence in the empirical literature to support that theory. Okay. So those are two of our rejoinders. In addition, as you noted, we did a study where what we did was we said, well, let's make it as hard on ourselves as we can. All right. And we did a study where we surveyed a couple of hundred adults in Wales, and we measured the extent to which they endorsed those self-enhancing extrinsic values of money and status and power and such like that. And what we did then was we chose the 30 most extrinsically self-enhancing oriented people that we could, okay? So we only did the rest of the study on people who at a dispositional level say, this is what's important to me, money, image, and status, okay, and power. And then we brought them into the lab, and we randomly assigned them to either have intrinsic values primed in their mind or extrinsic values primed in their mind. And so what we did was in the intrinsic group, we gave them some intrinsic values to write about. And in the extrinsic group, we gave them some extrinsic values to write about. And then what we did was we had them all interviewed with the same interview about how much they cared about the loss of British countryside, climate change, poor kids in Britain, and dying children in the developing world. So we had two kind of social outcomes and two environmental outcomes and two that were kind of local and two that were international, right? And then what we did was we had a linguist who didn't know anything else about the study look at all of the interviews and code them. And he didn't know what we had primed. He didn't know who these people were. And he coded them, these interviews, for how much concern the participants expressed about helping other people or about changing the problem. And what we found was that even among these really extrinsically oriented, self-enhancing people, just by having the thought of intrinsic values momentarily primed in their minds, they became more likely to say, hey, you know, this is a problem and somebody needs to do something about it. Okay. You know, whereas the extrinsically oriented people who've been primed with extrinsic values were acting just like you would expect. Okay. They were saying, well, like there's one just really terrifying quote in there where an extrinsically oriented person primed with an extrinsic value says about dying children in developing nations, well, that's just the way life is over there. It's nothing much to be worried about. Okay? That's what they say. Whereas in a person who's extrinsically oriented that gets primed with intrinsic values says something like, you know, this really is a problem. It's not just. It's the haves and the have-nots again. We should do something about that. So these data really argue against the critique that people have levied against us and show that all of us have all those values, okay, and that we can prime those intrinsic values even in relatively hardcore, extrinsically oriented people. I would say just one last thing is that even if it were the case that it was hard to prime intrinsic values in extrinsically oriented people, what the data show is that most people report that what they care about most are intrinsic values. So let's not sort of forget that most people care about things like their personal growth and about their family and about helping the world. And we don't want to mess that up by appealing to extrinsic values in those individuals, too. So, you know, we can't throw kind of the baby out with the bathwater on that.
Sure, yeah. Another really illustrative example you gave of the danger of appealing to extrinsic values, the example you gave of the bees. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure, you bet. Well, I don't know if this is the case in Britain right now, but in the United States, at least, there's a massive die-off going on of bees. Is that happening?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, what you see sometimes are statements like, well, we've got to save the bees because bees are worth N billion pounds for the economy, okay, because they fertilize the plants and the crops and all that sort of stuff. Now, let's say that you make that argument about bees, okay, and that motivates people to say, yeah, we got to save the bees. Great, let's go save the bees. And that's all fine and good for the moment. Now, let's say that 5 years from now, there's another species which is dying off, but we can only show that it contributes 100,000 pounds to the economy. Essentially, what an environmental organization has now done has been to teach its listeners that the way to evaluate whether or not to save a species or a piece of land is dependent upon its economic value. Okay? We should save bees because they're worth N billion to the economy, but we shouldn't save this species of toad because it doesn't matter for the economy. Essentially, by having framed the debate along economic lines, again, in the long run, the environmental organization will have worked against its ultimate goal of preserving all species and preserving our habitat.
Yeah. This research is really powerful stuff. Since you've published, do you feel that you've gained traction in a wider field in getting it acknowledged?
I actually do. I can't say that about all the research I've done, but I can say that about this. You know, we've worked with a variety of different organizations in England and Wales and Scotland who have offered to give us space to give talks on these things. We've reached out to many different organizations, environmental organizations and social organizations in Western Europe and in Scandinavia. I'm actually just back from a month in Australia where I gave about a dozen talks to environmentalists and others about these kinds of topics. And there's no doubt in my mind that especially among younger generations of environmentalists, more and more people are recognizing that this is a way to be thinking, okay? It's another set of ideas that people are increasingly, I'm not saying that all people agree with them or that they always take them on, but more and more people are using these approaches as they're doing their campaigns, both in environmental and in social justice organizations. So we feel, I mean, we'd love it to be more, obviously, but we feel pretty good, I think, about the spread or how much this has caught on.
Great stuff. One of the ideas that I really liked was this idea of finding natural allies. Is it a good question to ask people, what is it you care about in that regard?
I think absolutely, you know, because one of the things that's very frustrating to me here in the United States is the extent to which the Democrats and the Republicans, for example, just can't seem to agree on anything. And if one thinks it's good, the other one automatically thinks it's bad. And it's just about party politics by and large. And I saw similar things happening when I was in Australia recently, where the conservative prime minister had put forth very sensible, great proposal with regard to more time off for new mothers that the progressive then attacked, okay?
Yeah.
And I think that what happens is too often we fall into the trap of thinking, well, what's best for my group? What's best for this, you know, my party? What's best for my business? Instead of thinking about well, what actually, and then we can fight with whoever else, right? But instead, and asking a question like, what's important to you? What do you care about? Usually, I think what that does is to help people to find common ground, okay, and to find a common cause. You know, I actually think that a lot of politically conservative people in the United States do care about their families an awful lot, just like the liberals do. And they do care about having a good world for their grandchildren. Yeah. And they do care about having more freedom and preserving the freedom that we have. And if you ask that kind of a question of a conservative and a progressive person, what I think you can often do is to start the conversation at a different point, right? To start the conversation at a point about values, about what's important. I think where conservatives and progressives often differ is the means to get to the end that they want, okay?
Is it also language as well? Like, you know, like maybe the term environment is a turnoff for conservatives, but often conservatives have an attachment to the land, or they don't like the term wetlands, but they might use swamp.
I think that's absolutely right. You know, and I think part of what Tom and I have been trying to argue, along with our other common cause colleagues, is that as environmental communicators and campaigners, what we need to do is to stop thinking about what we're going to push down other people's throats and instead figure out ways that we can actually communicate and join forces. Because the fact of the matter is there are so many trends going against us that, you know, the only chance we have, I believe, and I think Tom would agree, in order to solve climate problems and solve habitat problems and all of the rest, is if we join together across political boundaries, join together across sectors, and work together, because the resources we have are pretty paltry compared to the resources that certain others have. And it's only by finding that common ground that we'll have some success. And, you know, we actually just released another really cool study where we showed that if you framed a message about the environment in an intrinsic way, it later made people more sympathetic to a disability organization. Okay? And that's the idea that we all do all have something in common.
Yeah.
By activating those intrinsic values, it's going to help a disability organization and an environmental organization and a poverty relief organization, because all of those organizations depend upon intrinsic values in order to do their work.
Yeah. I'm just thinking of an example in the 19th century, in the UK at least, most social reform, positive social reform, was actually put through by conservative governments, and it had to sort of reach the mainstream before you needed your radicals or the outliers. Like you, to an extent, you know, making these points, but in order for it to work, you've got to get it into the mainstream consciousness, really.
I think that's right. And again, this goes back to what our argument has been, is that unfortunately, what the environmental organizations have done too much over the last 20 years have been to capitulate to the mainstream and to say, okay, well, we'll play your consumeristic, capitalistic, economic growth game in order to get what we want. And let's face it, it hasn't worked.
Yes.
Okay? It hasn't worked. And so a different approach is necessary. And that's what Tom and I have tried to articulate.
These priming and anchoring strategies are obviously very effective, but isn't this something that the advertising industry have known about for years in order to make us behave more extrinsically, and they spend billions if not trillions on it each year? At the risk of using extrinsic terminology, how does one compete with the immense power of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's something I think about every single day. Trust me, you know, because they do have far more resources. In a country like the United States, they own the media, right? You know, 95% of the media is owned by 5 or 6 for-profit corporations that make their money by advertising.
Yeah.
So how are you going to fight against that? And I would say that it's tough. Here's some of the things that give me hope, okay? the first thing that gives me hope is that when you take a look at lists of trusted organizations and people in the world, non-governmental civil society organizations tend to be fairly high up there. And whereas corporations tend to be fairly low down there, okay? And so even though we don't have nearly as much money to get out lots and lots of ads and billboards and all the rest and messages, we have something extra that's intangible, which is trust, okay, and which is goodwill. And by the way, I think this is another reason why environmental organizations shouldn't appeal to extrinsic goals, because I think that undermines that trust and it undermines that goodwill. I don't have data for that. But in any case, I think we've got that goodwill. So that's one thing. I think a second thing is that most people, again, I mentioned this a few minutes ago, most people say that what's more important to them than money and all the rest are intrinsic goals, okay, are their own freedom and personal growth and their family. But we live in a society which makes it relatively difficult to pursue those, and we live in a governmental organization which doesn't organize our lives that way. And so I think there's some things that we have to appeal to that's kind of stronger, if you will, you know, at the same time that it's kind of fragile, which I recognize too. There's something pretty powerful about those extrinsic goals which can distract people from their intrinsic goals. And I think that's a really fascinating and scary problem. But at the same time, we do have that appeal. And that's something we can pull on that can move people forward. I think the last thing that gives me hope is that how long did it take to end slavery? How long did it take to end child labor? How long did it take to get women the right to vote?
Yeah.
Okay. These were decades-long battles in all cases, okay? And none of them were won on the basis of an economic argument. All of them were won on the basis of what was right,
mm-hmm.
on the basis of intrinsic values. We free people. We give them the chance to be self-determining. We give them the chance to have good relationships and to contribute in a higher way. And so I think that history is also on our side,
mm-hmm.
In terms of social movements. On the other hand, what's scary is if the environmentalists are right, that if we don't change things around in 2 or 3 years, a decades-long battle is going to be too late. That might be something that's different about the environmental movement, which means that a decades-long battle will be too late. And that does worry me, I have to say.
Yeah, me too. One interesting example that gives me a little bit of hope in regard to sort of tackling commerce, etc., is Sao Paulo's Clean City Law, in which since 2006, no advertising has been allowed within the city. And what's interesting about it is that this has the approval rating of 70% of the occupants of the city, and it makes me think it could be a vote winner too.
Well, you know, Grenoble, France just did the same thing.
Right.
Just a week or two ago, and I think they're the first large city in Europe to have banned advertising, and they're going to replace the billboards with trees, I read. So I really think that this is a wonderful way forward, and one – I think that too often we tend to think, what can we do at the national level? What can we do at the international level, right? But I think that examples like what happened in Sao Paulo, what's happening in Grenoble, what's happening in other kinds of cities who are focusing on economic indicators of progress that are not just economic, shows the real power of working at a local level and then letting the ideas filter up. Instead of trying to change things at a national or international level and imposing them from above, okay?
Yeah.
And so when a city makes this kind of decision, or when a single nation, so for example, another very hopeful thing is in April, Brazil just banned all advertising to children under 12. You know, so now Brazil's one of the most populous nations in the world, right? Yeah. And so, you know, to the extent that these kinds of movements can happen, they show people that there is an alternative.
Mm-hmm.
They show people that, well, it doesn't have to be that way. It loosens up their imagination. Well, maybe my city could do something like that too, right?
Yeah.
And it motivates people. And it does show that people also have kind of had enough of certain features of our world. We just did a study, a nationally representative poll in the United States, that showed that majorities, substantial majorities of both Democrats and Republicans believe that there's too much advertising to children and that advertising in schools and such should be gone. There was even support for taxes on advertising with the revenue to be used to support education, et cetera. Even among Republicans, they were willing to support a tax, okay, at a majority level. And so, you know, I do think that our government and our many people in the government and many people in business are out of touch with what most citizens want. And we as citizens need to take back that control and that power.
In regard to that, a lot of your research suggests that people who are extrinsically motivated tend to be less happy.
Right.
It's not in the long run, arguably, for your well-being that you focus on extrinsic values.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, this is really where my research started 20 years ago, is showing that extrinsically oriented people, people who are more materialistic, actually are less happy, less satisfied with their lives, more depressed, more anxious, et cetera. In fact, in November, we just published what's called a meta-analysis, which is a statistical way to summarize across many studies. And we looked at around 200 different studies that have looked at the association between materialistic extrinsic values and well-being, and found that it is a consistent negative effect, which is shown across lots of different kinds of samples and lots of ways of measuring materialism and lots of ways of assessing well-being, too. So, you know, it's very clear that materialism and extrinsic values, at the same time that it's hurting the planet and at the same time that it's hurting civil society, it doesn't seem to be bringing people much happiness. It's undermining their happiness.
So to be more intrinsically minded or motivated or pro-social is not only better for the planet, it's also good for your health.
That's right. For both your physical and your psychological health, we found.
Yeah. So what suggestions would you give to be more intrinsically motivated?
Well, you know, in your own personal life, I mean, let's just set aside policy stuff for the moment. You know, I think asking that question, what do I care about? And is my life actually organized in a way that lets me live what I care about? You know, to me, that's the most fundamental question to ask. And if you say that what you care about a lot is your family, but you're working 65 hours a week and you never get to see your kids, or what you care about most is the environment, but you're not doing anything to help the environment, et cetera, it suggests that there's something out of whack between your lifestyle and your values. And I think this is a pretty common problem in many people's lives these days. And so, you know, then it comes down to making really hard choices about, you know, trying to bring your life into agreement with your intrinsic values. And I think that's one of the most important things to do. And that might involve things like working less. You know, so for example, for as long as I've been a professor at Knox College, I have taken 3/4 of my salary and only teach at a 3/4 level. So that I have more time for activism, so that I have more time for my family, and so that I have more time to play the piano and goof around, you know? So, you know, that's a choice I've made, in order to try to live my intrinsic values. So that's one thing. I think a second thing to do is so there's an assignment I give my students in one of my classes, and they have a choice. They can either spend the next 4 days keeping track of every single advertisement they see, or they can spend the next 4 days trying not to be exposed to any advertisements. Now, both of those are impossible assignments, okay? You can't successfully do either of them, but that's the point, right?
Yeah.
And the point is to help people become more aware of how much they're actually being exposed to these messages which activate and encourage extrinsic values, right? And to see them around them in ways that they didn't see them before. And, you know, while it's unpleasant oftentimes to see them and recognize them, only by recognizing them can you fight their power, and only by recognizing them can you make the choice to remove them from your lives,
yeah.
Okay? Either by, you know, stopping watching TV or canceling subscriptions to certain magazines or putting ad block on your computer or, you know, changing your shirts so they don't advertise Abercrombie and Fitch or whatever, you know, et cetera. You know, so I think becoming more aware of how the messages in your society and maybe the people with whom you hang out are encouraging those values is another really important way to kind of orient away from the extrinsic values and then start to make some choices that reinforce the intrinsic values and get you onto a virtuous cycle instead of a vicious cycle.
Okay, well, that makes sense. But is it also important not to sort of over-demonize our more extrinsic values? You know, after all, we wouldn't get out of bed in the morning if we didn't go out and achieve things or seek resources, etc. It's part of our evolutionary makeup. You know, as you say, we've got all these values. Is it more right. that these values are out of kilter and we just need to find more of a balance?
Yeah, well, you know, the example that I usually use when I talk about the circumplex is to think about it as a pie. Okay, and that each of those values is a slice of pie, you know, and what we do when we measure values is we assess how big the slice is for each person, right? You know, and so for some people, the slice of materialistic pie of their overall value system, their materialistic slice is pretty skinny, okay? For other people, it's a little bit bigger, and for other people, it takes up, you know, half of their values, let's say, all right? So I'm certainly of the opinion that as material beings who live in a material world, we need to eat, we need to clothe ourselves, we need to have some stuff, and there is stuff that does make our lives easier, right? You know, you and I are able to Skype across several thousand miles because of material things, right? And so there is something about keeping those materialistic values as a relatively small slice of the overall pie. You know, and I think I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few weeks with something I've been writing. You know, I think that the key word here is the word enough. Okay? It's the word enough. It's the word of, you know, when I sit and I eat, when do I feel like I've had not too little and not too much?
Yeah.
That's enough, right? And I think we need to ask this question of enough for our materialistic world too, and our materialistic pursuits. The problem is we live in a society which tells us we never have enough, okay? And and that we always need more economic growth, and we always need more stuff, and we always need a bigger paycheck, et cetera. And that there is no enough, okay? Well, that's not true. That's good for the capitalist economy, but that's actually not true for people's own psychological experience. There can be a sense of enough. It's hard to find that sense of enough, but one can find it, I believe.
Okay. And my last question, Tim, what is your understanding of the middle way, if any? And if you do have one, how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, my understanding of the middle way, you know, I would preface this by, I understand that the middle way is not Buddhism, from what I read, although certainly it sounds like it has some parallels with Buddhism. I used to meditate daily for 6 years, so I have some familiarity with that way of thinking. I'm also a very confirmed agnostic.
Yeah.
I'm not an atheist. I went through an atheist period, but then I realized, as I think the middle way people say, that's a belief too, right? That's a metaphysical belief too, to say there isn't a God or there isn't life after death.
Yeah.
I don't know. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, I don't worry about it anymore.
Yeah.
I think with regard to the kinds of things we've been talking about today, as I would understand the middle way, it goes back to this issue of enough. Of course we need an economy that is going to feed us and clothe us and provide us with material goods. And you know what? Capitalism has been brilliant at that, really brilliant at that. But it comes with a whole set of beliefs about human nature and a whole set of beliefs about what a good life is, and a whole set of beliefs about what progress is, that if you take them to an extreme, are really problematic for people and other species and the world. And furthermore, many of which don't have any empirical basis. I mean, for example, the idea that humans are rational is just ludicrous. We can be rational, but that we are always, and that's what so much of neoliberalism is based on. Yeah. So, you know, I think if we go too far to that one extreme, we've got a problem of, you know, the extreme of capitalism and that its beliefs. On the other hand, as they say in Proverbs, give me neither poverty nor wealth. Okay. You know, if we have a society which is just focused on, asceticism and forgetting the material body, then we've got a different kind of set of problems. And again, going back to the Buddha, I think his story is a really brilliant one in that way. You know, he starts with sort of everything material. He tries the asceticism, but then he finds the middle way, right? And, you know, and I know, again, that's it's not just the case for Buddha. It's the case for many other great thinkers, too. And so I think what we need to do is we need to find that middle way between a life of want and the grinding misery of poverty and the life of materialistic excess and more and more and more and more. And we need to thread that needle and find a set of beliefs that help us be happy, help us be nice to each other, and help us leave a good world for future generations and other species, and that are based on empirical work. And I think that's what we've done all along. You know, we've always tried to base what we've said on an empirical body of scientific literature, and I think the data are on our side.
Yes, that's true. You mentioned at the beginning of the talk, Tim Jackson, and I think he came up with a great quote at the end of his book, in his book Prosperity Without Growth, when he was saying, "Is this the end of capitalism?" And he quoted Star Trek. Well, it's capitalism, Jim, but not as we know it.
Right. I do think, you know, my next book is about hypercapitalism, actually, and about the problems of hypercapitalism. And I think that's what we have today. Yeah. Is we have hypercapitalism, and we have a form of capitalism that's gone awry, and that has taken over too much of life, and that really does not have values which are sustaining of people and of the planet. And, you know, we need to take the best from capitalism and get rid of the excesses and worse of hypercapitalism and develop a few other things along the way, too, and move on to another economic system, you know, and that's what humans have done. We used to be hunter-gatherers, right? We used to live under feudalism. We've lived under capitalism. Some have lived under communism. It's time for something new. It's time for a new economic system, yes.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more, Tim, and I'll look forward to reading that when it comes out. Anyway, well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Tim. It's been a real pleasure.
Same here. I've enjoyed it a lot.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.